This podcast is brought to you by Kefir Her. Whether you're feeling the effects of menopause or your menstrual cycle, discover what's key for you in less than 5 minutes with tailored supplement recommendations, information and insights on kefirher.com.
Hi, I'm Renee.
And I'm Donna. Welcome to the Kefir Her podcast.
In this series, we aim to educate and open up honest conversations with both medical professionals and real life women.
We want to shine a light on those topics that sometimes go unspoken about and help empower women to know what is key for their health and well-being.
Hi, we're delighted today to be joined by the incredible Dr. Deirdre Lundy. I've a bit of a fangirl thing going on here. I'm delighted to be chatting to you today, Deirdre, in particular, given that it's your birthday. I feel you're great taking the time out to talk to us today. So very happy birthday, first of all. Let's kick off with that. So in terms of what we can talk about, I'm going to keep it really open today. Like, I think we can cover, everything between the two of us. There's so much to cover, really, isn't there? But first of all, I wanted to ask you about your book.
Yeah, so we just finished the last of the edits, so it's gone to publication now. I have no idea. Like, I think it should be available the end of this year, going into next year. It's a soup to nuts of menopause, hormones, non-hormones, but mostly, and it's factual, like anything that's in there, I took a lot of information from the BMS handbook and stuff like that. But it's just mostly funny. It's just mostly stories of my own menopause, my mother, my sisters, patients over the years, the kind of insane stories that people have told. And so I just tried to keep it. I wanted to do a fun read that was also informational, informative. So I hope people will like it.
Well, congratulations. Amazing. I can't wait to get my hands on it. That sounds absolutely brilliant. And I agree, getting that balance of something that's really educational, but also entertaining and fun to read. I've no doubt you've hit the mark with that one. So I think that's great. So congrats.
I don't want to take away from some people's experiences. Of course, there are people who've had a hellscape of a menopause. But, with everything I do, and I think you probably would agree, that if you could just bring a little bit of, sure, what are you going to do? And roll on to it. Yeah,
I think that's accessibility, isn't it? It makes people really, I think people click with that. And you need something that is going to keep your page turning. And our job is, it does roll like that. There's days where your heart is torn out of your chest by the stories that people tell you. And there's days that you roll around with people, and because life is funny, and things
are so funny. It is so hilarious. I gotta tell you what our most recent thing is. Here in Holly Street, our the direct menopause clinic line is one digit different from some poor family that lives in the area. And people have a habit of leaving the most explicit voicemails on this gentleman's. So he rang us to say, will you change your phone number? Because if I have to hear vagina on my voicemail one more time, my wife is going to leave me.
Oh, no. That's unfortunate. Yeah, it's
brilliant. So we changed the number. We're changing the number.
Okay, well, that was very kind of you. Yeah. Tell me a bit about, we cross paths a lot in kind of a more educational sense with different things, but I've never really had the chance to sit down and pick you apart a little. Tell me about your background. Like, how did you end up where you are?
Yeah, so I grew up in Long Island near JFK Airport. Anyone who's been to New York knows Long Island because you have to land there to get to the city. And I always wanted to be a doctor. Since I'm a little baby kid, I want to be a doctor. But you know what American educational system is like. Like, it's really expensive to study there. And my parents would have had a huge loan for me. And because my four grandparents were all born in four different counties of Ireland, I enjoyed dual citizenship. So long before I was ready to go to university, somebody had suggested that if I studied in Ireland as an Irish person, I would save a fortune of money. But the only bugbear there was that I had to do this thing called the Leaving Cert, which I had never heard of before. So I thought, well, how hard can it be? So when I wasn't even 17, I was still 16, I flew to Dublin and I stayed in a hostel in Donnybrook. And I went down to Alexandra College.
I have three nieces that go to school there. Yeah. I know it. Yeah.
It was the only school this friend of my mother's had ever heard of in Dublin. So that's how I ended up.
So that's where you went.
So that's where I went. And it worked out fine. The whole reason I applied there was I thought I could stay there, but they wouldn't let me stay there. I don't know why. They didn't have room or something. So I stayed in a hostel for nuns that were leaving their vocation in Donnybrook, which was an eye opener. And then I walked down the hill to Alex every day all by myself. So like looking back, if I would I have let any of my 17-year-old kids at that stage do that? Heck no. But I couldn't wait to get the hell out of America and get over here. And then long before I actually got into UCD and qualified, I had fallen in love with the place. But then I met my husband in college. So that was it, you know.
That was the deal done, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
And how did you, so when you did medicine and qualified, yeah, had you a plan at that point? Look, I want to do women's health, or had you a leaning that way? So how did
absolutely
that sort of transpire?
So I my passion was emergency medicine and I really was drawn to that. But then I got married like right after we qualified and I was like, you know what? I was looking around just thinking, I don't want to be, other people I knew who were in medicine had to have full-time carers so that they could work the hellacious 80, 90 hour weeks that we're expected to work in training. And I just thought, I want kids, but I don't want that for them. So I took a year out when I got pregnant and I stayed at home full-time with my oldest kid, my son, Marka. And then I started saying, okay, I got to get back to work, but I don't want to leave him for hours at a time. So the only two things you could actually do and become competent in relatively part-time was what they used to call family planning, which we now call sexual and reproductive health, and dermatology. So yeah, so that's how come I ended up in sexual and reproductive health. I had no interest in it. But then when I got to do it, I thought, God, this is fun. And it actually is a lot of fun.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. You mostly make people's lives better and you make people happier. You know, whereas saving lives is kind of cool and exciting, like for you, there's also the downside, which is things can go badly, badly wrong, and you take that home as well. Whereas in what we do, I mean, obviously we diagnose cancers and we have to help people through those experiences as well. But for the most part, it's all good news, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, and it's quite generalized, isn't it? It's like you get a lot of, there's a bit of counseling thrown in there too, which is quite nice because you're really, I think, and we're probably afforded a bit more time to kind of to tease through that with someone, which is nice.
Yeah.
And see it more kind of holistic, you know.
Yeah, because general practice, you know, you're expected to be good at the things you and I do, menopause, sexual health, reproductive health, in general practice. But as you well know, the time shape of general practice nowadays, the demand for time, it doesn't lend itself to really fulfilling interactions. And I would say on both parts. So the GPs are frustrated because they want to talk and they want to spend more time, but they don't have it. There's a queue piling down the street. And then the patient has waited days, if not weeks, for to talk to you. And they have a list of things that they're really worried about, but they can't even address two of them, three of them, because you don't have the time. Whereas mostly, I don't know. But I mean, is it because, I don't know why, but we're luckier, I think, in that we do seem to be able to, If it takes as long as it takes.
Yeah. And what about in Hollis Street? So where you're based now. So tell me about the clinic that's there.
So I'm in one of the consulting rooms here. It's an ancient old Victorian hospital, as you know. So we're very, very limited for space. It was a bloody miracle that I'm doing this from a room instead of my car, because I've actually done phone clinics to patients from my car.
Your car.
In this hospital. It is chock-a-block. So, and we're all fighting each other for rooms and stuff, but the atmosphere is so positive. This is really one of the most women-centered environments I've ever been in, and I really love being here. And I think it gives you a little bit of gravitas, you know, when you're hooked up. Like I used to work in private menopause care, no more than yourself, you know, and that was nice, but it wasn't as, this is better. This is better because I have the strength of the hospital behind me. If I'm really worried about something, I can literally just text or walk down the hall to a gynecologist that some I'm friendly with and say, please, 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 would you do this for me? And then they will, you know. It's a great environment. And we have a full-time 39 hours per week clinical nurse manager, advanced nurse, Claire McElroy is her name. And she is literally, she's the tour de force of this place. Like the woman is so passionate about not just the care, but also delivering it in a timely fashion, making sure we keep our waiting lists in check, reaching out to other collateral services so patients can be referred internally, externally, whatever. She just never stops thinking about it, whereas I regularly stop thinking about it.
I doubt that for me, but yeah, I empathize. I think
I'm watching television, I'm like, oh, did I have a meeting tonight? I swear to God, that happens sometimes, you know.
Well, that's because you're being pulled probably in 20 million different directions for different things. But yeah, I think being part of a multidisciplinary, because it would be similar in Rotunda where, and also I'm similar to you, I'm sort of hoping to, I'm following in your footsteps a little to kind of get something off the ground in a hospital. You but that sense of being multidisciplinary.
Yeah, you will too, because the Rotunda, like I'm there occasionally for the Mirena clinics we run, the Coil clinics. And again, like, oh my God, all the consultants are, for the most part, like younger, they're far more, you know, pro women and listening to what people want. It's a good day for women in hospital care.
Yeah, that team approach is lovely, isn't it? That feeling of support and knowing that you have access to scans or hysteroscopy or whatever, like investigations that might be really important, and not having to be in your GP surgery with your phone half the day trying to get through to people and sort of begging and pleading to get stuff done. It's nice to just have the length of the corridor between me. Yeah, no, I totally agree. I suppose on that topic, if you like, what are, in your experience, kind of having, because you've really encompassed so much of women's health in Ireland. It's not just menopause and between contraceptive and sexual and reproductive health.
The menopause really only took off a few years ago when the demand started to go up and people were like, what the hell is menopause? What the heck is HRT? Like GPs really didn't feel comfortable discussing it. And I was like, well, I've been doing that for 30 years. I can tell you what I know. But then the demand for that information just started to snowball, you know?
Has it changed? So what women were saying to you, I don't mean about stigma, because I think we all know that a lot of that ability to have the conversation and the barrier to that has kind of broken down in the last few years, which is great. But in how women actually report their symptoms or what is important to them, has that changed? Do you think?
Yeah, totally. And in part, it's to do with the media. So I've been working pretty much exclusively in sexual reproductive health since like 91, 92. And it was very, very common for people who had significant menopausal symptoms to come in, mention them, and we would put them on products or offer them alternatives. We ran a special clinic in the Cahill Brewer Street Family Planning Clinic for women going through the menopause transition under 40, which, you know, POI is a very serious medical condition. It absolutely needs hormonal therapy. And we had no problem treating people who needed help. And then this publication came out 20 years ago in 2002, and the popular press ran with it. And it basically made headline news, and it said, HRT gives you breast cancer, which was not true then. It's not true now. But you just couldn't unhear those words. And so for the next 20 years or so, well, next 15 years, I would meet people 25 with no estrogen, already osteopenic, already with horrendous symptoms. They would not take the hormones they absolutely needed because they were so terrified of getting breast cancer from them. It was actually really frustrating. And so it kind of, the whole industry sort of died for about 10 or 12 years. And then in 2015, the NICE, the National Institute for Clinical Healthcare Excellence, they were like, you know, people, get it together. The WHI study from 2002 was ridiculous. It had its conclusions, and the editorial they ran about breast cancer in no way is actually backed up by the information they gathered. And if people are in the menopause and struggling, give them what they want, give them what they need, and stop scaring the absolute crap out of them. And now the media has actually embraced that. So now all of a sudden someone told me years ago, did you know HRT is good for you again? And I was like, I've been on it the whole time.
It was
time.
Always, yeah. Yeah, it so, hasn't changed. Yeah.
It hasn't changed for me. You know, I looked at that study and I said, what a load of crap. And it was, you know, it had nothing to do with the people we see. It used products we never touch, you know. So that's yeah. what happens. Now, all of a sudden, the newspaper telling you HRT is a good choice if you need it. And now everyone and his sister needs HRT. That's great, except the medical profession has kind of
has to catch up a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was asked to for this, for the clinic in the Rotunda, they asked me to sort of give a talk, like a sort of a launch, if you like. But it was funny when I looked back, there was actually an article from 1991 about the menopause clinic in the Rotunda.
I saw that.
They had a menopause clinic. I don't know what happened and I don't know where it went, but like obviously in that gap of time, it just sort of disappeared. And now that trend has changed. But
I went over there. I used to go over there. So I was always budging over because I worked in Calabro Street 3 days a week and the Rotunda is just across the street. I wanted to upskill and there was no formal training open. So I used to just hang out and see, could I, you know,
loiter.
I did, I swear to God, like it was more casual back then, you know, strangers could wander in off the street and say, hi, I'm a doctor. Can I watch you do a hysteroscopy? Not hysteroscopy back then, but you know what I mean? And they were like, okay, yeah.
I sometimes feel like I do that though, Deirdre. Okay, I have moments in clinic where I feel like I've just wandered in and found a coat and a stethoscope, like total imposter syndrome when you feel a bit out of your and then it passes and all is good. But yeah, but I do think kind of going back to what you were saying about how that trend has sort of changed. I do think it's interesting how the media has sort of taken this new like look at things and how things are presented to women. And I get worried between this kind of two schools of thought now, almost that menopause on one side, that menopause is a disease or a deficiency state. I don't really ascribe to that at all. But then on the other hand, I feel if you're saying, well, look, we're totally over medicalizing it and it's not a disease and it doesn't need to be treated, that you're almost underplaying the really negative effect it can have on women and their right to feel better and the health benefits of things like HRT. So I'm somewhere in between, but how do you navigate that?
It definitely is somewhere in between. The difficulty at the moment is that there's a buzz going. So people who have less than perfect lives will sometimes reflect and say, well, maybe it is something to do with my menopause. Why don't I try HRT? Like as if it was some kind of a magic wand that, you know, a kind of a crappy relationship and annoying kids somehow will miraculously be easier to tolerate.
Be fixed with a patch. Not so much. Unfortunately. Yeah. You
know, like that is a problem. And there's two problems arise from that. First of all, unrealistic expectations. Mm. That's a big thing. So if you come in and you can't sleep at night because you're being woken up by being hot and dripping wet, I can fix that. But if you've got other stuff, more non-specific stuff, hormones are not going to necessarily make an impact. But because everybody wants to have a crack, and up to a point, why not? You know, we're experiencing shortages of products, shortages of appointments. So meanwhile, like we run a special service here for people under 40, and we segregate them simply because we don't want, like if you wake up and you're 18 years of age and your periods have stopped and you're in the menopause, you need to be treated with hormones and you need to be seen immediately.
Yeah.
We don't want those people getting lost in the crush with like we also have people well into their 60s and beyond who still don't feel as well as they would like to feel and think that trying HRT now in their senior years is somehow going to miraculously change everything. So we don't want those two extremes to get in each other's ways, if you know what I'm trying to say. But I agree completely. I mean, I have loads of friends and family members who went into the transition, came out the other side. Of course, they had some symptoms, but they were fine. I don't want them to feel, nor should they feel, that they've lost out, you know?
I feel like I meet that a lot, this kind of almost like a fear of missing out, or women who are not having symptoms at all, which is like a smallish percentage, but they're out there and they come in terrified, if I don't go on HRT, because I've heard all this good stuff about it. Am I missing out? And I have other women, I think, in their late 50s who are maybe flying it. They've normal bone density. They're doing their cardiovascular risks are well controlled. They're set up. They're doing well and they're not symptomatic. Yeah. They're on HRT and we discuss maybe stopping their HRT to see do they still need it. And they're terrified to come off it, which I understand. But I think telling women either side of this argument, they can't have HRT and they shouldn't, or that they have to have HRT and they absolutely should. Both of those arguments are wrong. We should be looking at the impairment of health, I guess. Yeah. Isn't that what it comes down to?
I don't know. I think at the moment, I don't know what the truth is, you know, and truth is a pretty loaded word. I don't think any of us know what the truth is because we don't have the facts yet. We've never seen a big longitudinal study of middle-aged and advanced middle-aged people who decided to go on hormones for maybe some symptom relief, but also looking at bones and heart and brain versus those who didn't struggle and decide, or for whatever reason, struggle or otherwise, decided I don't want any artificial extension of my hormone-rich time of my life, and then see what those outcomes are. We don't know that information. It could be that 20 years from now, the whole conversation is completely different. We may be saying it would be mad not to stay on hormones indefinitely, or we may be saying, God, that was an absolute dumpster fire with all those people who jumped on the bandwagon back in the early 2020s. You know, now we're picking up the pieces of this disease or that. The answer is we don't have the facts.
We'll emigrate together, Deirdre, if that happens, okay? But go find an island somewhere.
Seriously. Only thing that probably keeps me from losing sleep over it at night is all this huge popularity of HRT is I'm like the guinea. I'll take anything, you know me. So like I've been on hormones a long time. So if anyone's going to find themselves on the back foot, I'm going to be the first in the queue. So like, I don't know. That doesn't justify it. But you know what I mean? As scientists, we want to know exactly what the pros and cons, how do the benefits stack up against the risks? We don't have that information.
But that's the problem. There's been such a dearth of proper research because it wasn't trendy and people weren't interested in it and women weren't crying out for it because they thought it would give them breast cancer. And so it just sort of, it was gathering dust. But I find now the amount of women I'm talking to, and I just wish I could give them more definites. And I think one of the big ones, I don't know, I'm sure you could add to this list, but I find a lot of women will ask me about dementia. And does it reduce my risk of dementia? And the answer is I don't know. I mean, I don't know when you should start it, if it is going to reduce your risk. Yeah. I don't know what you should take to reduce your risk. I don't know.
I think a couple of things about dementia. First of all, it's absolutely terrifying. I've watched my mother-in-law, God love her, and now her other family members. It's definitely in that family. So it certainly seems to be an inheritable kind of a thing. And it's just a horrible, horrible way to sort of lose somebody before their body dies. Yeah, it's just vile. I would like to think that anything that protects your blood vessels can help reduce your risk of vascular. But the Alzheimer's type, we don't know. And there's tiny little studies that actually suggest maybe it could make it worse, but we don't know. We don't know is the answer. So I certainly
there's so many unanswered questions, aren't there, with HRT? Because, and especially I think because HRT is so many different types. There's oral, there's dermal, there's dosage differences, and then you're pairing it with the second hormone. Often, as women would know, you know, they're using the second hormone to protect the lining of their womb. So there's so many moving parts. It's hard. You need head to head studies of these things, and we don't have them. The other thing that crops up. Go ahead.
Well, the good thing about the resurgence of interest in HRT, if it does nothing else, I think it will drive the pharma industry and academic societies to actually start to conduct these studies because there's been so little interest and uptake in the industry that there was no funding, no desire for information. Now there's a hunger for information. So if nothing else good comes from this popularity of hormone use, it'll be that trying to gather people being willing to go on these studies should be easier, I would think, you know?
If you were designed, what would you change over the next 10 or 20 years? What would you love to have answers for? What would you love to see studied over the next 10 or 20 years?
We're going to be able to look back in 10 years' time even at all the women, in our country, and we're special, I think we're special, in that because we mostly pay for drugs, patient choice is a bigger factor in drug selection than it is in other countries. Like my poor sister in America, her copay in her health insurance, if she doesn't stay on the list of drugs that they approve, she's looking at $800, $900 a month. Somebody wanted to charge her $800 a month for estradiol patches because it wasn't on her plan. You know, this kind of crap. In the UK, they've got the National Health, which they're very lucky to have because it means free healthcare at general practice, free medicines, but within reason. And they're not allowed just, you can't go in and say, I must have this or I must have that, because if your local authority doesn't approve that drug, you're going to have to go pay for it. You know, in Ireland, because people, for the most part, pay for their own medications. And, you know, with a gratitude to the health protection agency, the choices we have in pharmaceuticals is actually quite good, as long as you can afford the 40 euros a month that it's going to set you back. So in Ireland, most people who have started back onto some form of hormone are on what I would consider to be the superior cocktails, the transdermal 17 beta estradiol estrogens, which is the one that we consider to be the most safe and hopefully the most beneficial. And then this micronized progesterone, which is ovarian identical progesterone. I can't wait to see look back data on outcomes on people who've been 5, 10, 15 years on those cocktails, because we don't have that information yet.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it will be interesting, I think. And testosterone, I think, is the other thing that really falls into that category. Yeah. Like, it's so frustrating, isn't it? And I think we've all had women who've really benefited from it. And we've had swathes of women who don't seem to have any improvement on testosterone. And I am
laughing. The people who make testosterone are just absolutely laughing because you know, to use the Australian license stuff, the pink box, is very, very expensive. It's much cheaper to use the off-label men's male hormone. Stuff. Yeah. And I'd say the people who make that are like, what the hell is going on?
We've this whole demographic that are using this product we did not design it for.
Exactly. And you know, it's perfectly legitimate. It's very legitimate for us as HRT prescribers to use men's male hormone in small doses. And we monitor the levels, you know, we have good guidelines around that. But we've been told from on high, you're not supposed to lash it out there like Smarties girls. It's for people with hypoactive sexual desire disorder. Yeah, which is not just I can't stand the sight of him, which is not a testosterone
issue. Don't have a pill for that. Yeah.
Exactly.
This podcast is brought to you by our very own brand, Key for Her. Whether you're feeling the effects of menopause or your menstrual cycle, discover what's key for you in less than 5 minutes with tailored supplement recommendations, information and insights on keyforher.com.
Please have 20% off on us by using the promo code KEYPODCAST in all capitals.
So now, having said that, a lot of people seem to derive additional benefit from it with regard to cognition and exercise tolerance. But officially, we're not meant to just use it for that purpose. And it comes with a lot of homework. Like, I don't usually do blood tests for average age 45 plus women who have menopause symptoms. I just take a really long history. I check their blood pressure and we usually do BMI in the hospital. I have to say, I never did that in private practice.
I will
somebody and say, like, markedly obese or fine. You know, those were the two categories. Whereas in here, we throw a number down for the system. The system requires it, you know, to prescribe drugs. And then after that, we start playing with hormones. You can't do that with testosterone. Testosterone always involves a blood test. And that's homework for everybody, you know. So I think there's a lot of boxes of unused testogels in people's houses.
Sitting around, I'd say. And I think it is frustrating. I'd love to give women statistics about, you know, well, in perimenopause, this is what the studies have shown. And it just doesn't exist. Yeah. And hopefully, like you kind of going back to what you said earlier with more interest in it, that will encourage a bit more funding for research for things like that. Yeah. It's funny to be it's so drilled into us in college and everything to be so evidence-based and then find yourself working in this area that's just like the goalposts are moving. And we've some evidence that's really like the Women's Health Initiative, which flawed, but at least you can work off, okay, well, we know something about something. Like there was
I actually love that study because as flawed as it was, and it only used horses' urine estrogen, and it only looked at medroxyprogesterone acetate, which is the most powerful and particularly arguably the more potent of all the progestogens out there. When you actually look at the impact that had in these very elderly women on breast cancer risk, it was minimal. It wasn't even statistically significant. So I was like, if that is as reassuring as that was, then how could what we're doing nowadays be any worse? So that's how I'm working off. The other downside, and I just think it's worth mentioning here, is because everybody is thinking, well, maybe I should try that stuff. The poor manufacturers have been struggling to keep abreast of demand, as you know. And I've actually had a few meetings with them. The people at Bezzens are very nice and they're always engaged. And they're like, it's not just a matter of saying, okay, guys, could you do some overtime? We're going to need to increase our production by 50%. Like the raw plant sourced hormone, like even just getting that stuff, you know, shipping it is challenging. Those fancy bottles where one squirt gives you so many milligrams, micrograms, whatever, those things cost a fortune to produce, you know,
because
they have to be scientifically accurate. You know, it's actually much cheaper to give someone a tube of something that they squeeze down a thingy and then you squirt it back on you, you know, like you do the measuring.
And a tablet presumably is easier than.
So everybody who wants to go on HRT, and I only want the bioidentical, I only want the good stuff. And I respect that. I only want the good stuff. It puts huge pressure on the market. So what happens is sometimes our little 22-year-old POI girls
can't get
their hormone, and that's life and death for them. You know, so like that is a problem, but I think that is improving. It has seemed to be improving.
Yeah. What do you think, or just to end on a sort of positive, what do you think are the positive changes that have happened in not just menopause, but women's health? And what do you think will continue to happen? Like, where do you see us going over the next 10 years?
I'm not political. In fact, I'm the opposite of political in that I'm inevitably going to say something that offends somebody, if you know what I mean. So, but I have to say, having worked with NWIP, you know, the National Women's and Infants Health, I can't say it, but you know what I'm talking about. There's no question that our health service is on its knees and needs to be completely overhauled. There's no easy solution to a very messy problem that's been 30 years in the making. But within that, there has been an enormous movement in women's health. So the Women's Health Task Force was a concept that the government supported, and they convened all these people to come in, medics and just people, normal citizens, to say, you know, what do you think really needs to be looked at when it comes to empowering the health of women in Ireland? And one of the things they said was menopause, and fair play to them, because as directly as a result of that conversation, your clinic in the Rotunda, my clinic here in Hollow Street, have got funding and are now up and accepting referrals. They've been looking at endometriosis care, which, you know, has been buzzing around, you know, and again, with validity in that, telling people who suffer excruciating pain on a regular basis, that's a natural part of being a female. You know, you can stuff that down your pipe. Like that's not acceptable. And that narrative is changing. So I think two things are happening. I think females are getting noisier, fair play. But I actually think that medics and the government are listening for a change.
Yeah, it's great to see, isn't it? I love that you kept that clean. I'm not sure I would have kept that clean. I would have picked maybe different words, but shoving down your... no, it's great. It is great. And hopefully that continues. I think there's momentum, I feel.
Yeah. And long may it last. I mean, the money they spend to make people... women, females, whatever, people who struggle with ovarian related conditions, including endometriosis, menopause. It actually is not expensive to make people happier and healthier. It really isn't. Yeah. It's not science. Yeah. It's not high tech stuff. It's just listening and then knowing what to do, knowing what the solutions are, you know?
And legitimizing so much of it. Like, I think that's so interesting because I think as a clinician, you come at this from your problem solving. I want to find the medication or the intervention that's going to fix the problem. And it always amazes me, I think, when you listen to patient advocates talk, and including with endometriosis, obviously they want to feel better and they want a way out of their pain or the symptom that's bothering them. But most of their gripe a lot of the time, like the negative experience, is actually centered around feeling dismissed, feeling like they weren't listened to, not the fact that they weren't given a cure.
Yeah.
But feeling like, you know, well, that pain, like you said, it's just normal. That's normal period pain to put up with.
So I have ended consultations, chats with patients with, okay, these are your options. And I have a feeling for you that it's going to be, which is the least worst thing. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
There are people that I know I'm never going to be able to make happy insofar as their condition is incurable. Their struggles are harder than other people, but it's never that you don't have choices. It's just that you may have to swan through a few of them before you get to the thing that gives you the greatest benefit with the least amount of hassle. And that's hard.
Yeah, I think chasing being asymptomatic is often really, it can be challenging with, and it can be challenging for some menopausal women, and definitely for endometriosis. We need more research into better interventions. But just being listened to and having that support of decision-making is kind of therapeutic, isn't it?
I wear this on the lanyard, you know what I mean?
What is that?
It's an ear. You know, like, there's all these things. I can do this Mirena, I can do the pill, I can do hormones, I can try this, I can try that. And I'm like, sometimes the healing begins with the listening.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think they a lot of patients just want to be told, I acknowledge what you're going through. That sucks. Let's see what your options are. Mm. And not told, you know, this is normal and you have to sort of figure it out yourself. Yeah. It's all about support.
Yeah.
Okay. That's great. At least we've ended on a really positive note, which is brilliant. I'm going to let you go enjoy your birthday. It's such a pity we're not in person. I'd have a little cupcake or a birthday coffee or something for you, but I hope you have a fantastic birthday. Thank you so much for talking with us, Deirdre. It was really interesting.
Pleasure. And I'm going to come visit you in the Rotunda.
Okay, well, I tell you what, we'll do a coffee in the Rotunda and a coffee in Hollis Street at
some point. Perfect.
Sounds like a great plan. Okay, thank you, Deirdre, and all the best.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Key for Her podcast. We'd be so grateful if you could hit subscribe, rate, and share this podcast with your friends.
For tips, tricks, and hacks on all things perimenopause, menopause, periods, menstrual cycles, and skin health, follow us at Key for Her on TikTok and Instagram.
Check out our website, keyforher.com, for more information.